From WXXI News, this is Arts Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour of Arts Friday goes back to the late 1920s, when the movie studios were loving all of this material with sound. Sound changes everything. If you can think of a song that changed your life, or maybe you still remember from your childhood, imagine the movie business when they realized what sound could do. Well, that's what they wanted. They wanted all singing, all dancing. It was the rage, and the studios wanted songwriters coming to Hollywood with all of these promises of riches and glory. Now, some composers loved it. Some were almost ashamed of the thought of being associated with Hollywood. Fabulous stories to be told, and they are told by the great Michael Lasser in the book called America's Songs and America's Songs 2. Well, coming up in a couple of Sundays, we all have the chance to learn from Michael Lasser, and you can join him, among others, for You Oughta Be In Pictures, Sunday, May 18th. From 2 to 4 p.m. at the Harley School. Tickets are available now. They're $25, and you can get tickets for that event by calling 258-0200. It's 585-258-0200 or online. But we've got a preview this hour, and I'm so glad that Michael Lasser is in studio with us now. Great to see you, Michael.
Good to see you, Evan.
Boy, the late 1920s really did change everything.
They sure did. Things were simply not the same. You know, the first talkie was not even a talkie. It was a silent movie with some singing, some talking and singing inserted so that Al Jolson and the jazz singer could perform, and it was revolutionary. It really did. It's something you think you know, movies, because by then movies were popular all over the country, and suddenly they're new. If you're looking for an analogy, take jazz. There was jazz for 20 years, and then there was Louis Armstrong, who reinvented it in the 20s. It was never the same again. It's that kind of not making new, but making again.
You hear Michael's voice. You know him from Fascinating Rhythm. He's the host and been the host since 1980, right, Michael?
Yeah.
That's Saturday mornings at 11 on a Classical 91.5. Also a longtime theater critic. And Michael and I was just saying, in fact, I was giving Michael a standing ovation for his book, America's Songs. Michael is a big fan of standing ovations.
No. No.
This is a conversation I bumped into in the studio, and I just have to share this. Before we even get to America's Songbook and all the great things there, this is your chance, Michael, to tell Rochester and beyond in Western New York, you've had enough of the obligatory standing ovation.
And it's not only in Rochester, it's all over the country.
Across the country.
To be ironic, it's a gift the young have given us. I assume that when you go to a rock concert, you spend most of your time standing.
Sure.
And it's leaked over into everything else. And so you're obliged somehow, if you sort of like it, to leap to your feet. And I would say that if your life has been changed so that it will never be the same again, you think about standing. That is, you can applaud politely for anything, and you should. If you like it more than that, you can put your hands over your head and clap. If you like it more than that, you can yell bravo. And then, if this has truly been life-changing, think about standing. Make the performer earn it, and don't give away your approval too easily.
Cheapen it.
If everything is equally good, then nothing is any good.
This reminds me of this reminds me of the Seinfeld episode where Elaine's boyfriend says that she is breathtaking, her beauty is breathtaking. And then the next day they see a friend's baby who is clearly ugly, and her boyfriend says the baby is breathtaking. And Elaine realizes it's meaningless. It's a compliment that's meaningless, and the standing ovation has become that way.
It sure has. And so what do you do next? I mean, rip off your pants and throw them on stage? I mean, where do you go?
See, this is just a taste of the wonderful wit and personality that Michael will deliver for us at the Harley School. That's Sunday, May 18th, and that's coming up here at 2 to 4 p.m. Now, Michael, you've been writing about the stories behind the songs.
Yes.
In the books America's Songs and America's Songs 2, but specifically at the Harley School, you're looking at songs from what?
From the movies.
From the movies.
The songs that the books are about are standards. These are songs that have lived on past their initial popularity. They're songs that millions of people can still sing at least portions of. They know the tunes. They know some of the lyrics. They become part of America's cultural DNA. And so we're going to be up on stage for an hour, Cindy Miller and Alan Jones and I. And how do you shape a program of 12 or 13 or 14 songs? And so this time we decided we would do some great standards that come from the movies.
You and your co-author for America Songs, Philip Furia, tell some wonderful stories. And if you haven't seen the books, what is so enjoyable about the books is that, as Michael explained to me earlier today, there are really three ways to read the books. I'm sure there are some folks who will read it cover to cover and devour the stories. Sometimes you'll hear a song and you'll say, I wonder if Michael and Philip wrote about that. And then you go, boom, there it is. You ought to be in pictures. Page 123, and you get this backstory. And if you don't mind, because the performance at the Harley School is called You Ought to Be in Pictures, can I start with just the story behind this?
Sure.
I loved this story. You tell the story that the New Yorker dubbed the composer, Dana...
Suisse.
Thank you for making sure I didn't mispronounce
it. It's a puzzler of a name.
It is.
S-U-E or... Yeah,
S-U-E-S-S-E.
Yeah, it's
Dana
a puzzler.
Suisse. The New Yorker dubbed Dana the Girl Gershwin because she wrote etudes and nocturnes as well as popular songs. And soon after she blew into town in 1934, Suisse and lyricist Edward Heyman bragged to a publisher that they could write a hit in 20 minutes. They locked themselves in a cubicle with a piano... And 18 minutes later, they emerged with You Ought to Be in Pictures. So you name that tune. I can do it in 20 minutes. They did it in 18, Michael.
One of the things that really engaged us, and this is, talk about backstories.
Yeah.
This is a backstory for the two books. Phil and I in the first one, and then I did the second one by myself. We were interested in collaboration. Because most of the songs of the Great American Songbook were collaborations. There was a composer and there was a lyricist. And we didn't want to do it analytically. What we wanted to do was approach it anecdotally and see if through a series of anecdotes we could give some understanding into the nature of collaboration, which is a marriage of sorts. And then also by doing it over time, see if the kinds of stories changed. And to some extent, they did.
Well, if you know Michael's work from Saturday mornings at 11 on Classical 91.5, for me, it's no surprise that the storytelling is so good in these books. Where can people find the books, Michael?
I assume you can find them wherever you can find books. That is, they'll be at Barnes & Noble online. They'll be at Amazon online. And then after the concert at Harley, we're going to be doing a book signing where people can get them, and I'll be happy to say hello and inscribe them.
Let's have our engineer, John Andrus, let's give him a workout this hour because we have some music to play, and maybe we'll start with Singing in the Rain. And I think that's an appropriate place to start because as you talk about the way sound changed the movies, this was one in particular where there was... quite a lot of effort and a lot of work that went into it. A lovely backstory on Singing in the Rain, Michael.
Sure.
Can you tell us...
you want to do the story first?
John's going to cue it up, so give us a little bit of the backstory.
Well, first of all, I think you know it's part of the movie. It's the title number from the movie Singing in the Rain, which many, and I agree, is the greatest musical ever made by Hollywood. And it was... It becomes this great dance number by Gene Kelly. And it's appropriate because, first of all, it's a movie about silent movies and the coming of sound. And Singing in the Rain was first performed in a movie called The Hollywood Review of 1929, one of the very first movie musicals. Arthur Freed, who was a producer at MGM, had started doing a series of movies that were biopics, loose biographies, loose with the facts, loose biographies.
As many biopics are.
Sure.
Sure.
Sure. And the funniest of all, the most absurd of all, is Cole Porter, in which he's happily married. Carrie is happily married to Alexis Smith, and in fact, he was married, but it was a marriage of convenience, and Cary Grant was gay. Not Cary Grant, Cole Porter was gay. But the original intent of Freed, Arthur Freed, the producer, was to make a series of musicals about great songwriters. And so you have Rhapsody in Blue about George Gershwin. You have Words and Music about Rodgers and Hart. He also does a series of movies that have songs by a single composer or a single team, and eventually did one with his own songs because he was a song lyricist before he was a producer. And so Arthur Freed uses the songs of composer Gnatio Herb Brown, lyricist Arthur Freed, in Singin' in the Rain. And so it appears in 1929 by Brown and Freed when they were young, and then when he's got some clout, he makes a movie in which he reinserts his own songs, including as a title song, Singin' in the Rain. And that was all in one breath.
All right, let's listen if we could.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again.
All right, Michael, why is this the greatest of all time?
Well, it's not the greatest song of all time.
The greatest musical.
Greatest musical of all time. The coherence of the story, the wit of the script, the appeal of the characters, the way in which the songs are woven into the telling, a combination of songs that both advance the plot but are also backstage numbers. So that is, they're numbers being rehearsed or something of that sort. And it's the way in which all of the elements in a musical have to come together to create suspense, delight. Singin' in the Rain doesn't do anything that other musicals don't do. It just does it better.
And at the time in the late 1920s, special effects were a little bit different. In order for them to have Singin' in the Rain, it was not the same as it would be today, right?
No, or then. Singin' in the Rain, the movie, was 1952.
Right.
The original Hollywood Review was 1929. It was introduced by a big star at the time named Cliff Edwards, who also on Broadway introduced Fascinating Rhythm in the Gershwin's musical Lady Be Good. That is, he was a big star. But he couldn't move because they hadn't come up with the kind of technology that allowed a performer to move very well with the recording going on. And so the microphone was stuck on a stage tree, and he had to stand there while buckets of rain poured down. He was wearing a raincoat. Everybody was wearing a raincoat. And there were dancers behind him in the rain, singing and dancing in the rain. But Edwards, who performed under the name Ukulele Ike, stood there with his uke, strumming his uke, and sang. And he was stationary. I mean, he had cement overshoes.
And had to be.
Had to be. By the way, people will know him, if they're not familiar with him, will know him because his career disappeared in the 30s. And Walt Disney was making a movie called Pinocchio in 1940, and he had a sound in his head for the song When You Wish Upon a Star, which was the great hit to come out of the movie Pinocchio, sung by Jiminy Cricket. That's Cliff Edwards. He wanted Edwards' voice. He had it in his ear somehow, and his people found Edwards, and they brought him to Hollywood, and he is best known now for When You Wish Upon a Star.
You're getting a taste from Michael Lasser of what you'll be able to see from 2 to 4 on Sunday, May 18th at the Harley School. It's You Ought to Be in Pictures. And it's not just Michael. You've got Cindy Miller and Alan Jones with you?
Yes. I work with them about a half dozen times a year. Some years ago, I was working with a number of singers, always a man and a woman, obviously, so you can do duets and things like that. And it was getting to be burdensome because I was encountering performers' egos, and it really was a nuisance. And I told my wife, I have one more of these to do, and then I'm not going to do them anymore. And the next one was with Alan and Cindy, both of whom I had known separately from this. And I had the best time working with them. And I went home and said, if I can continue to work with them,
I'll keep doing it. And
that was 10 years ago.
Wow.
They're wonderful singers. Alan is also our accompanist on piano. And they are not only talented, but God gets the credit for the talent and you get the credit for the craft. They are professional in every way. They're very talented singers, and they're open to anything. I mean, I'll throw a 19th century sentimental ballad at them. They came up through jazz, and I'll throw a Stephen Foster song at them they'd never heard of, and rather than saying, I don't know that I can do this, they'll say, hey, this looks interesting, let's try it.
What a great validation of their skills that 10 years on, it's still invigorating.
They're wonderful to be with.
Yeah. So again, that's at the Harley School, 2-4 on May 18th. That's a Sunday. Tickets $25 and still available. You can call 585-258-0200 or online for You Ought to Be in Pictures. This is one of those hours where if you're listening to Michael, you want the host to get out of the way, and maybe you just want to listen to Michael as much as possible. If you do want to join the conversation, I should probably tell you, you can. 585-263-WXXI, 263-9994, toll free no matter where you are. Finger Lakes, listening around the country, etc. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. In a moment, we're going to listen to a little clip from Over the Rainbow, and Over the Rainbow is an appropriate choice because not only are we going to be hearing and talking about that on May 18th, but there's a great story behind this. I did not know the age of Judy Garland when The Wizard of Oz came out in 1939. She was 18.
Yes.
Playing I think she's supposed to be 12 in the movie.
Yeah, they had to bind her breasts to make her look younger.
I did not know. So she not only was 18, but then had an affair with Johnny Mercer.
Later.
But as you say, that later affair was doomed from the start for a number of reasons.
Well, first of all, he was married. Second of all, there was a lot of years between them. And she obviously was not the strongest or healthiest person, healthy emotionally. Mm-hmm. What the studio system, what Louis B. Mayer and her own mother did to her really was pretty dreadful. It was the great love of Johnny Mercer's life, and it was remarkable because a lot of the songs of the Great American Songbook, although they feel very intense and very emotional and very personal, really are not. The men and a few women who were at work in those years, basically 1920 to 1950, although it stretches before and after, obviously, thought of themselves as practicing a craft. They weren't confessing. They weren't writing about themselves. One of the things I like to say is that they write about us. If it's in our hearts or on our minds, it'll end up in a popular song. They write about the American people at a given moment in our history, the attitudes, the beliefs, the feelings, the behavior. And so there's a kind of classicism to it. It's more Mozart than Brahms. And yet at the same time, some songs were personal. And there were songs that Mercer wrote during his affair with Garland that are evocations of the most intense kind of sexual passion. A song like, Down at the Old Black Magic, for example. It really is an extraordinarily erotic song. If you listen to it from that perspective, I think you'll pick it right up. But Over the Rainbow precedes that by some years.
Of course. Yeah. And so let's listen if we could, and we'll come back out and talk about it. Thank you.
that I heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow.
Can't mistake that. And yet, knowing her backstory now, it almost makes me sadder to think about that.
That young voice singing those words, I find to this day heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking, especially knowing that you felt like the trajectory that was endless, and but sometimes it doesn't quite pan out that way. Not that it was all tragedy for her, but it was, like you say, there were so many different forces, and we see those parallels today sometimes.
Sure,
in Duke
we
stores,
do,
don't we, Michael?
Sure, we do. But she. You know, she went through marriages, she went through legal drugs, but she was on uppers and downers long before anybody knew what they really meant. But there were Dr. Feelgoods always ready to prescribe. And as I said before, Louis B. Mayer, the head of the studio, and her own mother were very, very bad caretakers of her well-being.
With the Friends in Love concert in Rochester, and there's so many iterations of Over the Rainbow over the years, why has that stayed with us so much?
First of all, it's very simple. You hear it once and you half know it, both words and melody. My mother taught that song to me when I was 3 years old. I didn't know what it was. I was 3 years old. I didn't know it was a new song. This was 1939. And so I've known it all my life. If you got a minute, I'll tell you a wonderful story about
Please
it.
Please do.
Ernie Harburg, who was the son of Yip Harburg. Yip Harburg is the lyricist. Often people don't know who wrote Over the Rainbow. If they do know, they usually say it was Harold Arlen, the great composer who grew up in Buffalo. And if they say it's Arlen, then they only get to hum it because Arlen didn't write the words. Harburg did. Yip Harburg was one of our great lyricists and one of my personal favorites. His son was Ernie Harburg, who was a clinical psychologist. His wife, Dina Rosenberg, was a professor of theater. And they used to take vacations in odd places. Ernie today must be in his late 80s. They go to places like Machu Picchu, not Miami Beach.
Okay.
And one day they're somewhere in South America, Ecuador or Bolivia, on a bus, an old bus that's bouncing along a rutted mountain roads. The bus is full. There are things hanging out the window. You know, that it's almost a joke, almost a stereotype. And everybody on the bus is native except for Ernie and Dina. And they get singing. They adopt Ernie and Dina, their new American friends, and they start singing their songs to them. And their languages are Spanish and Quechua, the language of the Incas, which is still spoken, apparently, in some remote areas. And Dina's good in Spanish, so they're doing fine. And eventually, Ernie turns to Dina and says, "We ought to sing them an American song." And Dina says, "One of Yip's." And they start singing Over the Rainbow. Within four bars, everybody on the bus is singing it in their own language.
Wow.
They know it. It's the universal American song. It touches something. Even though the song is as simple as any song could be, it's as simple as a song by Irving Berlin, even though he didn't write it. It touches something deep. There's a sadness in it that we immediately connect to. And sadness in which hope hasn't died.
Michael Lasser, who is the host of Fascinating Rhythm on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. on Classical 91.5, is going to be hosting You Ought to Be in Pictures on Sunday, May 18th, from 2 to 4 at the Harley School. They're looking at songs from the movies. And we're going to take a short break. When we come back, the achingly sad Gershwin story that that his book, America's Songs, which is available now, and for, if you love music and if you love songs in this genre, a must read. For me, the achingly sad story behind Our Love's Love Is Here to Stay. That's, I love that story behind it. That's part of what is next. It's all coming up with Michael Lasser. You're listening to Arts Friday on Connections on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our next hour on this Arts Friday, how many musicians have a handwritten letter of praise from opera great Renee Fleming? Kerry Ratcliffe joins us to talk about his career and his elevation to lead of one of Rochester's top choirs, Madrigalia. And we'll preview the Lilac Festival with a look at the artistic talents that will be headlining at the Lilac Festival this year. It's all coming up next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson with Michael Lasser here. Michael and I were enjoying our break conversation so much that we almost carried it straight through, but that's the mark of a good conversation, Michael. We were just talking about the Gershwins, and we opened the hour by noting that when the movies changed, when sound changed the movies in the late 1920s, there were some who wanted to be in Hollywood, wanted to be in the movies, loved working with it, the glamour and everything else. And there were some composers who did not, who almost maligned Hollywood as it was something, sort of a lesser species.
Well, you know, even the songwriters who stayed and who wanted to stay were not happy with Hollywood. Because in New York, songwriters were treated like kings.
Hmm.
In Hollywood, they were treated like hired hands. Their work was put in and taken out without even informing them. They were not given the respect that they thought they deserved. In fact, Harry Warren, the great Harry Warren, once said to Jack Warner of Warner Brothers, complaining that he had just spent 3 weeks working on a single song, a 32-bar melody. And Warner exploded. "You telling me it took you 3 weeks to write some lousy song?" And Warren said, "No, Mr. Warner, it took me 3 weeks to write one good song."
What a great story there. What a story. But the story behind Love Is Here to Stay.
Yeah.
To me, was a very sad one, and one that I did not. I mean, I knew about George Gershwin was died at 38, but
right.
Some of the circumstances I did not.
Well, they went west because that's where the way the studios got the songwriters was to offer them huge amounts of money and the promise of eternal sunshine, and so they went. A lot of them went, would write some songs, and then go back. They couldn't wait to get back to New York. Irving Berlin remained a New Yorker. Cole Porter remained a New Yorker. Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer became largely movie writers. Yip Harburg went back and forth. The Gershwins had two minds. Ira loved Hollywood. George detested it. But George was very much an urban creature. He was a man about town. He was a playboy. He was a love 'em and leave 'em guy. Never settled down, never was able to make a commitment to any one woman. And he liked the high life, and so he couldn't wait to get back to New York. Ira, who was plainly lazy, and once said that he would have written much less if George hadn't been so ambitious and hadn't pushed him so hard, liked Hollywood. He liked the pool, he liked tennis, he liked sitting around not doing anything. Their last song was for a movie called, of course they didn't know it was their last song, was for a movie called The Goldwyn Folly. Sam Goldwyn was the producer. It's a real turkey. It's a dreadful movie. I've only seen it once, and that's quite enough. It's pretty bad. And they were working on this song called Our Love Is Here to Stay, originally. And in the middle of it, George died. They hadn't quite finished the song. It was the last song they were working on.
Again, George was 38.
Yes.
And what killed him, Michael?
He had a brain tumor. And by the time they operated, and think about brain surgery in 1938, by the time they operated, it would have made no difference. It was so spread. He was finished. And Ira consulted with their friend, composer Vernon Duke, and got a little bit of guidance, but basically finished the song by himself. And when it was about to go to the publisher, he had the clean copy in front of him. At the last minute, on an impulse, he picked up a pencil and crossed out the word "our," and it became "Love Is Here to Stay." And I think that's because, and this is increasingly the way in which the song is seen, it really is Ira's love song to his brother. And so to say "our love" was a little too close to the bone, a little more personal than he wanted to admit to, and so he crossed out the hour. And it truly is one of the great songs, one of the great lyrics that we have.
A great song that came from a turkey of a film.
Yeah, and it didn't really emerge because the movie came out and disappeared. It was awful. It died and took everything with it. And it wasn't until Stanley Donen rediscovered it. He was the director of the movie American in Paris, which features a score by the Gershwins. And he put it in there. And Gene Kelly sang and danced to it. And that let us discover rediscover what a great song we had let slip away from us.
So we had the risk of losing the song because the film was so bad, mm-hmm. The Goldwyn Follies was so bad, and we would have lost not only a great song, but one of the, as you say, not every song has that personal meaning, but this was one of the really raw and personal ones, and we could have lost it.
Yep, we almost did. Came very close. And rather than choosing the Gene Kelly version, I've chosen one that I like a lot because it includes the verse, and that's Michael Feinstein's.
Let's go ahead and listen.
The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend. The world and all its capers, and how it all will end. Nothing seems to be lasting, but that isn't our affair. We've got something permanent, I mean in the way we care. It's very clear our love is here to stay. Not for a year, but ever and a day.
It is beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
And then it makes me think about Gershwin dying at 38. And as you've said, you can't know what you've lost. But you can drive yourself crazy thinking about it, can't you?
Yeah, you sure can. I'm going to take a little 90-degree on you. That lyric is so wonderful. Iris, one of the hallmarks of the Great American Songbook is the coming and the mastery of the conversational lyric. We don't write anymore, beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. We write, the more I read the papers. It's talk elevated to song. The more I read the papers, the less I comprehend the world and all its capers, that wonderfully witty word. And then at the end of the verse, he writes, I mean in the way we care. It's talk, and yet it's filled with all of the emotion and the craft and the wit and the mastery of craft, the use of rhyme, the use of assonance, all of the techniques of the lyricist are at work there, but they're invisible because it's so close to perfection.
You've got to be really good to pull that off, I would think, elevating essentially conversation into song lyrics. And there's such a flow to that, and it's so mellifluous in that, mm-hmm. that it's hard to describe, and you're much better at describing than I am.
Well, George Gershwin's music had changed. In the 20s, his music was very percussive. I mean, he would beat the hell out of that poor piano. You understood why a piano was a percussion instrument. I mean, he went at it. The melodic phrases were very short and very staccato. Fascinating rhythm. You've got me. I got rhythm. I got music. Now he's writing, but oh my dear, our love is here to stay. That is the flow of music. The musical phrase is longer. It's more lyrical. The melody has a chance to flow rather than constantly being chopped by that jazzy drive of the earlier work. Those were great songs. These are great songs. Two decades, two styles, a younger man, a more mature man, a man making choices, wanting to go in certain directions. That is, I don't think you need to diminish the earlier stuff. But it's different, and Ira reattunes himself to it perfectly.
Speaking of different generations and different styles, you're not a fan of the overuse of the phrase of, well, that songwriter is a poet.
No,
not a big fan.
No,
of
not at all.
Why is that?
I think Dylan and Lennon are great songwriters. I don't think they're poets.
Why do we do that? Why do we?
Well, we need to elevate things, okay. Don't we? If I like it, it must be the greatest of all. When in fact, just like it. Take it as it is. Neither you nor he need to be made into
emperor. Hyperbole can cheapen.
Yeah, that's right. But I think it does a disservice. I'll give you, to both poets and songwriters, I'll give you one distinction between them. I could talk for an hour about the differences. Poetry has its own music. In songwriting, at least in the songs that I know, in almost every case, the music comes first. And so you have to adapt words to fit an external music. That's very few poems are written to somebody else's music. They're written to the music in the poet's ear. The lyricist has to take the music in the language, keep it, and somehow adapt it, make it fit the music that the composer gives us. It's a different task.
And doing it, you're fascinated by that relationship, aren't you, between the lyricist and the composer?
Yeah, I am.
It's easy to have some dissonance there, and so the best ones are really remarkable.
Yes, they are. They weren't always friends. They were collaborators. Sometimes they were. I mean, George and Ira virtually were married, you know. They would sit at the piano working them. It was a kind of marriage. They would sit at the piano together working back and forth. But then Ira would go away once the melody was set and work on his own.
Speaking of, there are some lovely photographs in America's Songs by Philip Fury and Michael Lasser, and America's Songs 2. Which, again, Michael, let our listeners know where they can find it.
Either online, any place that sells books. Or if you would like, you'll have to pay a little more because they'll be on sale at this price. But at the program that Cindy and Alan and I are doing at Harley on the 18th, there will be copies there, and I will be happy to inscribe them for people who buy them.
I see Rodgers and Hammerstein. I see Buddy Lewis and Nancy Hamilton.
Can I tell you my favorite photograph
of
the two
indeed.
Books? At the beginning of America's Songs 2, I found a photograph I'd never seen before. It's George Gershwin with his arm draped around the shoulders of Irving Berlin. And Irving Berlin, if I have, I don't like the idea of favorites. You know, what's your favorite show? I don't have one. What's your favorite vegetable? I don't have one. What's your favorite shoelace? I don't have one. But I do have a songwriter who intrigues me more than any other, and that's Berlin. And to see him with Gershwin, this extraordinary man, and by the way, Gershwin, when he was very young, had worked for Berlin as a musical secretary. He auditioned for him, and Berlin fired him. He said, go do your own work. You're too good to be working for me.
Wow, I'm looking at the photo right now.
Isn't it wonderful?
Couldn't have been long before George passed away.
I don't know.
I don't know offhand, but it says, two kids from the Lower East Side.
I'm looking for the caption. Oh,
yeah,
there it is.
That's a fabulous picture.
Berlin looks like he's around 40, doesn't he? Which would put him in the 30s. Berlin was born in 88. So, that would be not that many years before George died.
All right, let's. What else do you want to listen to? We've got some other options here. You've pulled some songs as time goes by. Blues in the Night, Blue Skies.
Let's talk about Irving Berlin, because I love to. No matter what it is, he wrote more and it was better. It's amazing. Nobody could write a Cole Porter song better than Cole Porter, but the one who came closest was Irving Berlin. Nobody could write a George Gershwin song except the way George Gershwin did, but Berlin came close. He was protean. He was plastic. Alec Wilder, in his great book, American Popular Song, was interested in the way in which American composers were innovative. And he looked for patterns to try and describe a career. When he got to Berlin, he threw his hands up and he said, it's as if each song is a separate thing. It's as if he writes each song as a kind of white heat of invention. And yet all the songs had to be accessible and all had to be simple. Anita Loos once sat with him while he was writing. And that was amazing because he was a private guy. And he'd write a song and tear it up and throw it away. And he'd write another song and tear it up and throw it away. And she said, Irving, this is back in the 20s, what are you doing? That song looked fine to me. What's wrong with it? He said, it isn't simple enough. The difference is between simple-mindedness, which we're all good at. We prove how good we are at it every day. And true simplicity, which is a paring away to and leaves only the nut, the essence of the thing. And if you listen to the great Berlin songs from All By Myself and Alexander's Ragtime Band and What'll I Do, and all the way up through the last great songs that he did in Call Me Madam in 1950, he had a half-century career, wrote more songs than any other songwriter, more hits than any other songwriter, more standards than any other songwriter. It's an extraordinary body of work. There really was a genius at work there.
And what are we going to listen to now?
Blue Skies.
We're going to listen to Blue Skies. Quick backstory here.
Yeah, he got a call one day from a performer named Belle Baker. She was in a Rodgers and Hart show, and she hated the songs they gave her. And she said, Irving, I'm desperate. Can you give me a song? He said, well, I got one that's not quite finished that would be good for you, because he knew her. And he stayed up the rest of the night, wrote it for her, and gave it to him. Now, if Rodgers and Hart had done that to him, inserted a song in one of his shows, he would have been livid. But he wasn't crazy about Rodgers and Hart, so he enjoyed turning the screw a little bit.
Let's listen to Blue Skies.
I was blue, just as blue as I could be. Every day was a cloudy day for me. Then good luck came knocking at my door. Skies were gray, but they're not gray anymore. Blue skies smiling at me. Nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing a song. Nothing but blue birds all day long. Never saw the sun shining so bright. Never saw the...
All right, Michael, what do you think when you hear that?
I think the amazing ability of Berlin. I'm back to it. It really would, because it's a Pollyanna song. Everything's wonderful. The storm clouds are gone. The skies are blue. And yet, even at that very rapid tempo that Joan Morris and William Bolcom use, you hear something sad in it. There's something bluesy in it. It's not a blues, but there's something bluesy in it. It's as if the character in the song remembers the bad time. Yes, it's happy, and I'm happy, and I'm kicking up my heels, and I'm dancing down the street, and there won't be any more problems for as long as I live. But I remember what it felt like.
That undercurrent is so subtle you could miss it.
Yeah. The way to find it is to do it a little slower. Then you hear it, because it rises. You do the slow it down just a little bit, and you'll hear it.
But modern music, there's not much subtlety, Michael.
What, there are always great songwriters. They may not appeal to me. That's my taste. Who cares? Nobody cares about my taste. But what leaves me dissatisfied in the songs I hear today are three things, very quickly. One, the absence of melody. And we'll put words to it, but those romantic melodies are gone, and the element of love that is romance, I think, is missing. The element of sex is certainly there and always has been. We were just too dumb when we were kids to recognize it, but it was there. The second thing is the repetitiveness within the lyric. Baby, we're going to rock all night. Now, I understand what that means, and I'm a smart guy. I got it first time I heard it. Baby, we're going to rock all night. Baby, we're going to rock all night. Baby, get a second idea. Think about tomorrow morning. Think about getting your socks off. Do something. And the third thing about them that troubles me is it slipped right out of my head. I was so busy talking about the first.
Are you implying that when Cole Porter said, birds do it, let's do it, let's fall in love, he was not just talking about love?
Well, let me quote a quick lyric for you. This is Gershwin and Buddy De Silva, George and Buddy De Silva, from 24. Ooh, do it again. I should say no, 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 but do it again. Now, the song will tell you it's a kiss, and I don't believe it for a minute.
But that subtlety is what I think is lacking. That's at least back in those days, you could hear Cole Porter or others and say...
Somebody once said that Porter never wrote a song that wasn't about sex. I'm not sure it's true, but the point holds.
Michael Lasser is going to be at the Harley School from 2 to 4 on Sunday, May 18th. You ought to be in pictures. Tickets $25, and they're available by calling 585-258-0200 or online, you can find them pretty easily. You can also pick up the books, America's Songs and America's Songs 2. Got time to listen to one more, Michael. What shall we listen to?
What haven't we used yet?
As time goes by?
Oh, sure.
And as John grabs that one, give us a little bit of the history.
It had been written in 1932, was not much of a hit, except a fellow at Cornell named Murray Burnett loved it. He was an undergraduate. And he became a playwright. And he wrote a play called Everybody Goes to Rick's. And it was the Hollywood studio, Warner's, took an option on it because they were still devouring things that might in any way be made into a sound picture. And of course, it became Casablanca. Everybody Goes to Rick's. And when Murray Burnett and his collaborator, Joan Allison, wrote the play, they knew they needed a song for Rick and Ilsa, for their love affair, the great love song of their affair. And he said, what about this song I loved when I was an undergraduate? And it was, of course, As Time Goes By. Max Steiner, who wrote the music for the movie, hated the song, wanted to drop it, and nagged the producer, Hal Wallace. And finally, Wallace said, as they were finishing up, all right, Max, write me a song this weekend and we'll use it. Max comes in on Monday with the new song, except Wallace has had a chance to think. They finished the actual shooting. Ingrid Bergman has left. She's gone to another studio or another lot to shoot a new movie in which she plays a woman who collaborated with the Nazis, for whom the bell tolls. And she's had her head shaved. It's just growing back because that's what they did to those women. And she's got very short hair. Wallace realizes he's going to have a wig made because there are some dialogue scenes leading into the song they need to use between Bergman and Dooley Wilson. And he says, the cost of a wig, the hell with it. And so if Ingrid Bergman hadn't had her hair shaved, we would never have rediscovered. That's a song that got a second chance as time goes by.
Let's listen.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by.
Would you like some icing on the cake?
Yes, please.
They had to get Dooley Wilson from... They decided they wanted Dooley Wilson. They had to get him from another studio, so there had to be a negotiation, and we'll give you this one if you give us that one. They finally get him. He signs the contract, and then they realize he can't play piano. Welcome to Hollywood in the 30s and 40s.
Michael, it has been such a pleasure this hour.
I've enjoyed it, Evan. Thank you.
And for those who, if they want to come out and see you, you've gotten a quick taste, and give us one more quick taste for what they're going to hear 2 to 4, May 18th at the Harley School. You ought to be in pictures. What's it all about, Michael?
You're going to hear Cindy Miller and Alan Jones singing some of these great songs and more. We'll be doing about 13 or 14 of them in the hour, hour and 20 minutes. And the deal is I get to talk, but they don't let me sing. And that's okay, because I shouldn't be allowed to. We'll let you rediscover some great old movie songs.
What a wonderful way to spend Arts Friday, our first hour. Great pleasure. America Songs and America Songs 2, must-haves if you have any appreciation for these genres. Thank you, Michael.
Pleasure. Thank you.
All right, quick break here, and we'll come right back on Arts Friday. I'm Evan Dawson, John Andrus behind the glass, and you on this Friday, you're listening to Member Supported Public Radio.